Hello, this is Bruce, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from today's issue of the New York Times, and today is Thursday, October 30th, 2025, and we are on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. One of our top stories, Jamaica and Haiti tally hurricane victims as Melissa slams Cuba. About 20 people, including children, died in a Haitian community, and at least three bodies were found in Jamaica, officials said as they began to assess the huge storm's damage. Article by Nazanin Ghaffar and Andre Poutar, Jovan Johnson, and Michael Levinson. Hurricane Melissa blasted Cuba and Haiti with torrential rain and howling winds on Wednesday, inflicting even more damage just hours after it devastated parts of Jamaica, ripping the roofs off homes and hospitals, flooding villages, and littering roadways with trees and electrical poles. In both Haiti and Jamaica, the authorities began to tally the dead. Around 20 people, including children, died in a Haitian community where swollen rivers spilled into homes, and five bodies were found in St. Elizabeth, a hard-hit parish in southwestern Jamaica, where Melissa struck the island as a Category 5 hurricane. In that parish, the storm left a complete disaster, said Floyd Green, the architectural minister. Entire buildings have collapsed, he said, adding that he had heard reports of villages where every single house is without a roof. The dead in St. Elizabeth Parish included four men and a woman, said Superintendent Coleridge Minto, the head of the St. Elizabeth Parish Police. The parish's church, tax office, council office, supermarket, and bakery were also very badly damaged, he said. Everything has been washed away by floodwaters. And so the situation is, in fact, very bad, he said, adding that there was an urgent need for support. Communication problems and power outages were hampering the authorities' ability to assess the full scope of the devastation. Nearly 80% of the country was without electricity on Wednesday morning, said Dana Morris Dixon, Jamaica's information minister. I know so many people have said they cannot reach their families in western Jamaica. That's because of damage to the telecoms infrastructure, she said at a news conference. About 25,000 Jamaicans were staying in shelters, and officials warned that many might not be able to return to homes that had been destroyed or damaged. Some may also not have enough food, because farms in St. Elizabeth, known as Jamaicans' breadbasket, were devastated, Dennis Zulu, a United Nations relief coordinator in Jamaica, said at a news conference. Andrew Holmes, Jamaica's prime minister, said in a statement to Jamaicans, especially those in the hard-hit West, that the government was racing to help them. We know many of you are hurting, uncertain, and anxious after Hurricane Melissa, but please know that you are not alone, he said. Our teams are on the ground working tirelessly to rescue, restore, and bring relief where it's needed most. The eastern parts of Jamaica, including the capital, Kingston, were mostly unscathed, officials said. All the roughly 25,000 tourists who were in Jamaica were accounted for and in good health, Edmund Bartlett, Jamaica's tourism minister, said in an interview on Wednesday. And Desmond McKenzie, a Jamaican minister who has been coordinating the emergency response, said three babies were born during the storm. Despite our challenges, we rise to the occasion, he said in a news conference. Melissa, which toured across Jamaica with 185-mile-per-hour winds, had weakened to a Category 2 hurricane with 120-mile-per-hour winds when it made landfall in Cuba early Wednesday, but it was still packing a powerful punch as it roared north over the island and headed toward the eastern Bahamas. Roofs flew off buildings and houses collapsed in urban and rural areas, said the governor of Cuba's Granma province. Yanisti Terry Guatnez said, described as interminable night and morning, and shared photos on social media of an uprooted tree, a swollen river, and buildings partially submerged in muddy floodwaters. Parts of eastern Cuba had received more than 14 inches of rain, and some small cities and towns were swamped, officials said. The Cuban municipality of Seguatitamuna, home to about 45,000 people, was partly flooded after the Saguatitamo River overflowed, and videos on social media showed water rising over doorsteps and creeping up to rooftops there. Cuba's president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, said more than 735,000 people had been evacuated ahead of the storm, which knocked out power in the country's eastern provinces. Although Haiti and the Dominican Republic were not directly in the path of the huge storm, it was also bringing the risk of catastrophic flash flooding and landslides to those countries, the National Hurricane Center said. The hurricane was expected to cause a dangerous storm surge in Turks and Caicos on Wednesday as well, the center said. About 20 people, including children, died in the Haitian community of Petite-Goave as a result of the storm, according to Ronald Lewis, a technical manager for the Municipal Civil Protection Committee. Sudden floods pushed the Daigou River over its banks around 4 a.m. on Wednesday, flooding more than 160 homes, he said, another dozen people remaining missing. The requests for aid are immense, Mr. Lewis said. Hygiene kits, drinking water, shelters, sanitation kits, clothing, and heavy equipment to work on the river because if nothing is done, the waters could cause the same damage again if it rains. Rain is falling intermittently, and we are proceeding with the evacuation of residents. The U.S. State Department said it would deploy disaster response teams to Caribbean countries impacted by Melissa. The department also said in a social media post that it had activated urban search and rescue teams. In the past, the U.S. Agency for International Development had taken the lead on disaster response efforts after hurricanes in the Caribbean, but the Trump administration shuttered the agency earlier this year. From our real estate section, the best states for retirement. Balmy Florida still tops the list, but several western and midwestern states offer their own advantages for seniors. Article by Arnessa A. Howell. With its sunny beaches and friendly tax code, Florida is the best state to retire in, according to an annual study by WalletHub. But if you were looking for a lower cost of living, and you don't mind experiencing all four seasons, you can find excellent alternatives in western and midwestern states. Using data culled from a host of sources, including the U.S. Census Bureau, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the study assessed each state across three main weighted categories: affordability, quality of life, and health care. Within these categories were 46 secondary metrics, such as share of population age 65 and older, quality of public hospitals, and general tax friendliness. Florida has sun and sand, yes, but it also has the third highest percentage of older residents, and plenty for them to do. And then there's what it doesn't have: state income, inheritance, or estate taxes. There's a lot of talk in Florida now about doing away with property taxes, which would make it even more appealing to retirees, said Chip Lupo, a WalletHub analyst, though he cautioned that high prices are spurring some retirees to look elsewhere. Minnesota is colder and less tax-friendly, but it finished in second place thanks to its stellar health care, with the highest number of facilities, including the original and largest Mayo Clinic campus, and the second most nursing homes of any state. Overall, its seniors are healthier and safer. Colorado, with its excellent health care and lack of estate or inheritance taxes, finished third, followed by Wyoming and South Dakota. Wyoming was found to be the most affordable state and offered a high quality of life, but it finished 38th in health care, because it's sparsely populated and access might be a problem, Mr. Lupo said. South Dakota scored points for its many employed seniors, a strong nursing workforce, and its top-ranked geriatric hospitals. Best and worst states for retirement, the 10 best states for retirement in the categories in which they scored highest, and the 10 worst states in the categories in which they scored highest. Best was Florida with affordability and quality of life, Minnesota, healthcare, quality of life. Number 3, Colorado, healthcare and affordability. Number 4, Wyoming, affordability and quality of life. Number 5, South Dakota, healthcare, affordability. Number 6, Pennsylvania, quality of life, healthcare. Number 7, New Hampshire, quality of life, healthcare. Number 8, Delaware, affordability, healthcare. Number 9, North Dakota, healthcare, affordability. And number 10, Wisconsin, affordability and quality of life. Now, for the worst. At number 50 is Kentucky, healthcare and quality of life. The next worst at 49, Louisiana, healthcare and quality of life. 48, Mississippi, quality of life and healthcare. Number 47, Washington, affordability and healthcare. Number 46, New Mexico, quality of life, affordability. Number 45, New Jersey, affordability and quality of life. Number 44, Rhode Island, affordability, quality of life. Number 43, West Virginia, healthcare, quality of life. Number 42, Arkansas, quality of life and healthcare. And finally, 41, Hawaii, affordability and quality of life. In music, from Los Angeles, 22 years after his death, Warren Zevon is getting his due. The singer and songwriter was the focus of a tribute concert in Los Angeles on Friday. Next month, he'll be honored by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Article by Bob Meyer. At the conclusion of Join Me in L.A., The Songs of Warren Zevon, a 32-song, four-and-a-half-hour concert held at the United Theater in downtown Los Angeles on Friday, Jackson Browne shook his head and marveled at his old friend's uncompromising vision. Listening to all these songs, it occurred to me that Warren never pandered at all. Browne said in an interview, he never dumbed down for anybody or tried to write a hit. He just wrote and went on writing the best songs he could until the moment he was gone. That was his singular achievement. The event, guided by a troika of Zevon intimates, his son Jordan, his longtime collaborator Jorge Calderon, and his artistic champion Browne, served as a celebration of Zevon's music and a prelude to being honored by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame next month. Zevon's career was marked by considerable critical acclaim, little commercial success, and bouts of self-sabotaging behavior. Yet, the most shocking twist came with his final act, a sudden cancer diagnosis, followed by a long goodbye and farewell album, before death in its many varied forms, physical, moral, romantic, was long the central preoccupation of Zevon's work. The irony, of course, is it's unlikely that any of the honors he has posthumously received, including Grammy Awards for his swan song LP, The Wind, would have come to pass had he lived. And he kind of planned it that way, Jordan Zevon said in an interview, referring to his father's dramatic exit. Dad knew this would be the outcome. Renowned for his macabre sense, comic sense, Zevon also had a penchant for tender sentimentality. A classically trained musician with a rock and roll heart, and a littérateur whose tastes ran the gamut from Graham Greene to Mickey Spillane, Zevon made music that was an unlikely mix of brains and brawn, high art and low culture. Once back in the 1970s, Browne introduced him in concert as the Ernest Hemingway of the 12-string guitar. Afterward, Zevon corrected him. "No, Jackson, the Charles Bronson of the 12-string guitar." The evening's house band, the Wild Honey Orchestra, was a collective of local musicians, led by the keyboardist Jordan Summers and the drummer, Nick Vincent, abetted by several notable Zevon session alums, including Rick Murata, Bob Glob, and Leland Sklier. The concert set list covered the breadth of Zevon's career, dating back to his stint in the 60s pop duo Lyman Sabel. Steve Staley and Christy Kalin teamed for the airy psychedelia of Follow Me from 1966, while the Smithereens' Dennis Deacon, joined by the young fresh fellow Scott McGautry, and the one-time Beach Boys member David Marks, ripped through Outside Chance, a buoyant Beatlesque romp. Zevon's pop period was fleeting, and his musical destiny lay elsewhere. After releasing a lone hard rock album in 1969, he spent the early 70s developing a distinctive songwriting voice, resulting in the grand leaps that would define his beloved work from later in the decade. Those songs, including berserker anthems like Excitable Boy and I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, were given a convincing reading by the country music scion Shooter Jennings, who managed to capture Zevon's idiosyncratic cadences and phrasing. Standout from Zevon's 80s era, which followed a long wilderness period and rehab, were performed by the veteran singer-songwriters John Wesley Harding and Marshall Crenshaw, who both brought a lived-in truth to somber reflections like Reconsider Me and Sentimental Hygiene. Despite his literary reputation and classical credentials, the young Zevon was mentored by Igor Stravinsky. His music was often simple and earthly. When asked his occupation, Zevon would typically reply, folk singer, and used the oldest traditions of the form. His catalog is filled with shanties and marital rhythms, rebel songs, and funeral laments. The pianist and singer Leslie Mendelssohn located the deep solemnity in the Mariner's Tale, Mutineer, and Steve Wynn of the Dream Syndicate captured the naked violence and desperation in Play It All Night Long. The country star Dwight Yoakam, striding the stage in a full-length duster and Stetson, put his stamp on the junky, picturesque Carmelita, throwing a bluegrass hitch in his voice as he pleaded, I'm all strung out on heroin on the outskirts of town. While Zevon's songs often ponder the darkest aspects of the human condition, the concert also highlighted an often overlooked spiritual strain in his output. Zevon, who was born to a Jewish father and a Mormon mother, had a religious sense that was, as his hero Green once put it, a troubled paradoxical faith. Yet a sense of grace permeated many of the performances at the United. There is a gospel quality in Warren's work, Brown said. He may not have had the voice to give them that treatment, but some people naturally bring that out when they sing them, just by having the air pass through their lungs. The journeyman R&B singer Billy Valentine was one such example, offering a beatific accidentally like a martyr that found both the soulful ache and gospel uplift in the tune, bringing the 1,600 plus in attendance to their feet. Susan Cowsill also struck a chord with Muhammad's Radio. The singer had recorded the song as a solo piece in 1976, before Zevon released his own version, and before Linda Ronstadt scored a small hit with it. Carving new filigrees into the song with her soaring soprano, she confirmed Zevon's mastery as a melodist. Calderon, a sweetly voiced singer, played spare and eclectic renditions of the songs he wrote with Zevon at the end of his life, highlighted by a poignant Keep Me in Your Heart. Jordan Zevon seemed to relish tearing into some of his father's gonzo character studies, including Monkey Wash, Donkey Rinse, and Lawyers, Guns, and Money. But on Studebaker, one of Zevon's great lost works, he softened, finding an existential beauty in the song's rueful denouncement. I'm up against it all, like a leaf against the wind, and that Studebaker keeps a breaking down again. While the concert neared its end, with the full lineup gathering for a rousing take on Zevon's only hit, Werewolves of London, the true climax came a bit earlier as Brown led a string-fueled version of Desperados Under the Eaves. Arguably Zevon's masterwork, the narrative begins at the Hollywood Hawaiian Hotel, the embodiment of Nathaniel West's dream pump. The song's protagonist, a thinly veiled version of Zevon, battles alcoholic tremors and waits for California's inevitable cataclysmic quake to consume him before a haunting coda, an air conditioner hum recast as a hymnal, urging him to look away down Gower Avenue. Brown's performance summoned a sudden wellspring of emotion in the crowd, with many visibly wiping away tears. On the most fundamental level, people listened to Warren, Brown said after the show. They listened and they heard him, because they were looking for something they needed. By that measure, he delivered on a tremendous scale. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Now some world news. China's pause on rare earth controls. What to know? China has suspended export controls announced this month, but was conspicuously silent about rules imposed earlier, which are snarling global supply chains. Article by Keith Bradshaw. China has agreed to stand down on enforcing some of its recent limits on exports of critical minerals, but apparently not all of them. Following a meeting on Thursday between President Trump and Xi Jinping, China's top leader, the Ministry of Commerce in China said it would suspend for a year the export controls it issued on October 9th. However, China made no public commitment to retreat from earlier limits, which it imposed in the spring and last winter, and which continued to snarl global supply chains. The October orders were, in the words of U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, a bazooka at the supply chain and the industrial base of the entire free world. They included a halt to any further export of technology or equipment that might help other countries develop their own rare earth mines, refineries, and magnet factories, except with permission from China's Commerce Ministry. Mr. Trump said Thursday after his meeting with Mr. Xi, held in Busan, South Korea, that he expected the year-long suspension would be extended before it expired. But China's Commerce Ministry said it planned to study and refine its October 9th regulations, which have drawn considerable criticism from Europe as well as the United States for being very broad and also ambiguous. Perhaps even more important, the ministry did not offer public assurance that it would back away from the stringent export control rules that it imposed on critical minerals in April and last December. The April rules halted exports from China of 7 kinds of rare earth metals and rare earth magnets made from them, except with licenses issued by the ministry. The December rules imposed similar requirements on 2 metallic elements vital for making certain semiconductors and 2 other elements needed for military ammunition. European and American business leaders and officials say that only half their requests for exports licenses for rare earth magnets are being approved by the ministry. Many factories are barely receiving enough shipments from China to stay open, and some have had brief closures. The export controls are putting the stability of global supply chains at risk, the European Union Chamber of Commerce in China said last month. Factories that need the magnets to make products like brakes and car seats have been unable to replace their usual inventories. Companies had to run down their stocks when the ministry approved very few licenses for the first 2 months after issuing the April regulations, while the ministry was setting up licensing procedures. Shortages have sent the cost of rare earths skyward. The price of dysprosium, used to make heat-resistant magnets for brake motors, steering motors, and other automotive systems, has risen outside China at least six-fold to $1,200 per kilogram, said Thomas Krumer, a rare earths consultant in Singapore. In deciding to back off its October rules, China may have realized that it had earlier underestimated how much damage it would do to the industrial base in the West and how that would hurt its reputation as a reliable supplier. My impression is that they had no idea just how many products would be affected by this licensing system, Mr. Krumer said. It was not immediately clear what China's agreement with the United States on Thursday would mean for Europe. European Union trade officials were scheduled to hold talks with a Chinese delegation in Brussels on Friday. China has been withholding rare earth magnets from Europe while demanding that Europe reduce its tariffs on Chinese electric cars. The West is beginning to invest heavily to limit its rare earths dependence on China. The United States has little or no capacity to quickly increase production of rare earth magnets. It could take a decade for the United States to develop a completely independent supply chain of rare earth magnets and other rare earth materials, said Sabrin Chowdhury, head of the commodities at BMI, a country risk and industry analysis company that is part of the Fitch Group. A further worry is whether China will actually allow exports of rare earth processing equipment to help the West set up its own supply chains. Many Chinese manufacturers of the equipment stopped exports early this year after receiving administrative guidance from Beijing. Even in the absence of new regulations at the time, rare earth industry executives said whether these shipments will resume following the suspension of the October rules remains to be seen, Ms. Cowherty said. Nazi missiles that terrorized Britain are now home to starfish. Tons of toxic German munitions dumped in the Baltic and North Seas after World War II have become an unlikely refuge for marine life, a new study has found. Article by Alexander Nazarene. Late into World War II, Nazi Germany introduced the Fieseler V-103, or V-1 flying bomb, an early cruise missile. It was the first of the Wunderfallen, Wunderwaffen, or Wonder Weapons that were supposed to turn the tide of war back in Germany's favor. There was also the more famous and formidable V-2, subject of the 1973 novel Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Although the V-1 missiles were used to terrorize London and Antwerp, Belgium, they could not stop the Allies. After the war, some 1.6 million tons of mostly German munitions were dumped into the Baltic and North Seas. They have remained on the seafloor since, making for a macabre museum of human destructiveness. But a new study by German researchers has found that the sunken munitions also serve as a surprisingly robust sanctuary for sea life. Published last month in the journal Communications Earth and Environment, the study is the first to document the extent to which some marine species have turned the surfaces of bombs meant to kill into thriving shelters. It's absolutely insane, said Jens Greenert, a deep-sea researcher at the Geomar Helmholtz Center for Ocean Research in Kiel, Germany, and one of the paper's authors. It's 80 years ago that this war ended, so two or three generations later, people have still to cope with the remains of this war. Apparently, nature is a little bit more easygoing. Like the wildlife that is in probably come to thrive in the radiation-soaked expanse of the Chernobyl exclusive zone, as well as in the demilitarized zone that bifurcates the Korean Peninsula, the inhabitants of Europe's marine graveyards seem to exemplify the dramatic extent of nature's adaptation to humanity. The V-1 missile contained about 1,800 pounds of TNT. Some sunken bombs have had their explosive elements exposed, meaning that harmful compounds are leaching into the water. We started researching this issue because we are concerned about the environment due to the release of toxic substances from the munition, Dr. Greinhardt said in an interview. The explosive itself is toxic. It's carcinogenic and mutagenic, he added, meaning it can cause cancer and alter DNA. But, as the researchers found, the sea life doesn't seem to mind. It mostly remains confined to the outer metal surface of the bomb, which turns out to be an adequate sanctuary, regardless of what darker dangers lurk within the warhead. The ban on fishing around sites, where munitions were sunk, proved another advantage. The fauna simply realized, okay, there's a productive space where they can live, Dr. Greinhardt said. To conduct the investigation, a remotely operated vehicle, named Captain Blaudar, after a fictional German character, descended to a depth of about 70 feet in the waters of the Bay of Lübeck, off the northern coast of Germany. There, the vehicle, which was equipped with a GoPro camera, took footage of 9 different V-1 missiles that had been partially submerged and were in various stages of degradation, according to the paper. Some were almost intact, others rusted out with the explosive content strongly dissolved, the authors wrote. The site had not previously been explored. The researchers then counted the number of species visible on Captain Blauber's video feed. They also used computer analysis to count the smaller organisms. Seaworms, invertebrates, also known as polychaetes, accounted for some 90% of the total abundance, the researchers observed. But they also found sea anemones, starfish, and in a few outlying instances, 3 fish species, Atlantic cod, black goby, and European flounder, as well as the stray crab. Some munitions, the researchers noted, hosted dense aggregations of starfish, perhaps, chemically attracted to the exposed chunks by some components in the explosives. Despite the fact that a single type of invertebrate dominated, making for low diversity, the profusion of life on the munitions in general was remarkable, the researchers noticed. The munitions showed a density of 43,184 individual organisms per square meter, far higher than in the surrounding sediment, 8,213 organisms per square meter. That was almost identical to the density of organisms on natural surfaces, such as rocks, observed in the Baltic Sea. It is important that we got actual numbers, e.g. the abundance of diversity of the fauna that occurs on and around munition dump sites, Audrey Vadinum, a research scientist at the Seckelberg Amir Research Institute in Wilhelmshaven, and the lead author of the new study, wrote in an email, "Now we have actual data to work with." Captain Blaubar did not disturb the explosives or the organisms that lived on them, but it did bring back water samples, which showed concentrations of explosive matter that approached toxicity thresholds. In other words, the fact that some sea worms are thriving on the old V1s does not compensate for the bomb's ruinous impact on the environment and possibly human health. "We only have a few studies," said Jacek Beldowski, a professor at the Institute of Oceanography of the Polish Academy of Science, who searches the threats marine life and was not involved in the new study. "There is no systematic approach, no monitoring, so we do not really know how the situation will revolve," he added. "But we know that all the mechanisms that are dangerous exist, and the chemicals exist. At the moment, nothing really, really bad is happening. But in the future, no one knows." European policymakers want to raise the munitions and dispose of them more responsibly, given just how much marine life they would be disturbing, they may have to proceed with increased caution. We know that the munitions create these artificial reefs and biodiversity increases, said Dr. Beldowski. But he added the contaminants are still being released from the missiles. are entering the food chain. So, it's a double-edged sword. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From Arts and Television, William Fichtner really is that guy. The prolific character actor spent decades playing memorable supporting roles. He makes it look easy. It wasn't always so. Article by Ashley Spencer. Chances are you've seen William Fichtner in something. In some of the actor's most memorable roles, he's left his mark via a single scene, as in The Dark Knight and Crash. Other times, he's been an integral part of an ensemble, like in Heat, Contact, Armageddon, Go, The Perfect Storm, Black Hawk Down, and Prison Break. He's also had comedic turns in Entourage, Blades of Glory, and the sitcom Mom. That durability has earned Fichtner around 100 film and TV credits and a place of esteem among that guy actors, the beloved performers who aren't household names, but whose faces are instantly recognizable and inspire gleeful, it's that guy reactions. Any scene he's in, he becomes a load-bearing wall, said John Lee Hancock, who gave Fichtner a starring role in Telemasca, The Secret Order, Hancock's new Anne Rice horror series on AMC. It's going to stand, it's going to work. But even if you've never seen a single thing he's been in, Fichtner 68 has an aura that merits a double take. He is lean and slightly leathered, and he just looks cool. Such was the case when we met for an interview at a cafe in Glendale, the LA-adjacent city, where Fichtner has lived for nearly 20 years. I had just pulled into the parking lot when a jovial voice called out, "Are you here to see me?" And there was Fichtner, all tousled hair and sly grin, climbing out of a Toyota Tacoma pickup truck. On that particular Monday, his fingers were adorned with bejeweled gold rings that once belonged to his father and grandfather, a turquoise stone he'd procured in New Mexico, hung on a leather cord around his neck, trailing behind the V-neck of his unbuttoned black Henley. Fichtner isn't exactly comfortable talking about himself or his craft, but unlike many of the calculating characters he played, he exudes a casual warmth. He's William in credit only. To everyone else, he's simply Bill or Billy. His last scene-stealing role is on Telemasca, which premiered Sunday on AMC and AMC Plus. It centers on a secretive society that tracks supernatural beings, and Fichtner plays the show's chief antagonist, an enigmatic vampire named Jasper, who appears in only teasing glimpses until about halfway through the six-episode season. Then, Jasper gets to let loose, throwing back test-tube vials of blood like they're shots of top-shelf tequila, and toying with the show's young lead, Nicholas Denton. Fichtner has often played an adversary of some kind. Just don't call him a villain. I don't look any part of it like it's a villain. I don't think that you are... know how to play that, he said as he stirred his latte. even people that are tough people, bad people, I don't think they're bad people. They have their own set of circumstances. Fitchner's circumstances involved growing up in the suburbs of Buffalo, New York, with four sisters. His mother was a nurse, and his father was a mechanic in the U.S. Air Force. In high school, Fitchner had been a hybrid freak jock stoner, he said, and he'd never even attended a school play, let alone acted in one. When he got to SUNY Brockport, he majored in criminal justice, with half-hearted plans to go into law enforcement. He has played many lawmen, but doesn't see any connection. You guys play a cop because it's a cop. You play a cop because who's the guy? That's what I care about. In order to graduate, he needed to complete a requisite fine arts course. So he chose an improv class, without being entirely sure what improv was, because it met later in the day. Once inside the classroom, however, Fitchner found the exercises uplifting, and his improv professor saw untapped potential. Encouraged, he took a few more theater classes and spent the summer, after graduation, reading the industry guidebook, How to Be a Working Actor, over and over and over, until he auditioned and got into the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in New York City. Many of his peers had extensive performance backgrounds, and Fitchner said he was always so intimidated, he said. I felt like everyone had the perfect language to talk about my motivation. I wanted to go to the drama bookshop and say, can I buy some method here? He managed to procure an agent, but the real work didn't come quickly. He spent years waiting tables and bartending, among other jobs, to make ends meet, until finally he landed a part in an off-Broadway play. A few TV commercials materialized, then some single-episode parts, and after nearly a decade of hustling, a recurring role on the soap opera As the World Turns. It wasn't until he was 36 that he finally scored what he considers his first substantial film role, playing a slimy club owner in Steven Soderbergh's The Under Earth in 1995. He still recoils at the mention of actory terms like method and motivation. His method isn't any one thing, he insists. He holes up in what he terms the coolest freaking man cave, a converted tool shop behind his house. He strolls wintry streets in New York. He makes soundtracks for his characters. But while Fitchner describes his role prep in nonchalant terms, his good friend and Black Hawk Down co-star, Kim Coates, said he's watched the actor tackle each part with laser focus. To play a blind scientist in the 1997 sci-fi film Contact, for instance, Fitchner sought advice on how his character would likely move through the world, if he'd use a cane or a guide dog or both, at the Jewish Guild for the Blind in Manhattan, and sat in his apartment blindfolded for an hour each day, while other Black Hawk Down actors took around 20 minutes to consult with an on-set stylist about their military haircuts. Coates recalled that Fitchner spent a day and a half going over every last detail to get his hair just right. Billy's process is as good as it gets, Coates said. He just doesn't like talking about it. Does he mind being labeled a character actor? I'm fine with that, Fitchner said. I don't want to play me. I'm not sure how exciting that would be. Despite enduring that prolonged fallow period in his 20s and early 30s, he said he's turned down more roles than he's taken. I was pickier and choosier at times than I maybe should have been, he said, but I can't help it if I don't feel it. He's developed a zen approach to his life and career. He doesn't pay attention to social media, and he doesn't look back with regrets on any roles he missed out on. It's another actor that got a job. God bless him, he said. His focus at the moment is on the kitchen renovation he and his wife, the actress Kimberly Khalil, are undertaking, and whether his beloved Buffalo Bills can pull off a Super Bowl run. In recent years, he has dabbled in writing and directing, and he'll next appear in season 2 of Beef, and on the Apple TV thriller series Lucky. Many of his past projects have also found new fans in the streaming era. When he goes to the YMCA to swim laps, he's amazed that teenage boys approach him to tell him how much they love Prison Break, which ended its original run in 2009. Fichtner is not currently involved in Hulu's Prison Break reboot, which follows a new group of characters. There's also a Heat sequel in the works, but Fichtner's character died in the first film. As our conversation wound down, and he polished off a second latte, Fichtner reflected on getting older, though he said he's not quite at bucket list age. I don't think there's any sort of missing piece or anything I haven't yet explored. I just don't look at it that way, he said. I don't feel like I'm looking for something I haven't found. Then he dashed home to catch the Bills game. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Tim Meadows just wants to keep showing up to be funny. 25 years after he left SNL, he is still finding new audiences, most recently with a new CBS sitcom and a role in the DC Comics universe. Article by Esther Zuckerman. Tim Meadows was in the main cast of the short-lived NBC sitcom The Michael Richards Show in 2000, when he encountered an older character actor with a big white mustache. The actor was Bill Irwin, who had hundreds of acting credits including Home Alone, Plane, Trains, and Automobiles, and dozens of one-off roles in sitcoms, like his ill-fated one with Meadows. But if The Michael Richards Show proved ultimately to be forgettable, the interaction with Irwin did not. I said, "You had a long career. I've seen you in everything," Meadows recalled telling him. He goes, "Yep, I've been around for a long time. My secret for success? I always want to play the neighbor who comes in, says something funny, and leaves." Meadows chuckled to himself. "That's my hero," he said. "I want to be that dude when I'm 70, 75 years old." He is coming pretty close. Since leaving the cast of Saturday Night Live a quarter century ago, he has made a career of being the kind of performer who is never top of the marquee but always vital to the comic alchemy, providing quotable lines and memorable expressions whenever he appears on screen. Tim has a flawless, dry delivery, like Bob Newhart. Tina Fey, a longtime collaborator, wrote in an email. The two performed together for several seasons on SNL, and Fey has tapped him for roles ever since, notably as the exasperated principal in Mean Girls. He is, Fey added, the perfect put-upon voice of reason. Meadows, 64, has been a steady presence in movies and television since his first SNL episode in 1991. But this fall, he has been particularly fruitful. He just finished a run in season 2 of the HBO Max superhero series Peacemaker, in which he played a government agent with a fictitious ailment that prevents him from distinguishing between birds. And earlier this month, CBS premiered DMV, a workplace sitcom set at a Los Angeles branch of the Department of Motor Vehicles. Reviews have been mixed, but Meadows' mordant performance has been widely praised. Meadows plays Greg, a surly employee constantly bemoaning his life. The DMV isn't a stepping stone for him, it's a last resort, the show's creator, Dana Klein, said she had Meadows in mind even before she started writing the pilot. "I mean, he can get a laugh on the word no," Klein said in a video interview. "I don't know how he does it." Meadows is not the biggest star to emerge from his era of SNL. He never had the movie career of, say, Will Ferrell or Adam Sandler, but he has never been far from the spotlight. He appears to be content with his place in the industry, though lately his brand of acerbic wit seems to be in demand. Asked whether he feels that there is a new momentum in his career, Meadows responded in with a laid-back air of self-deprecation. "I think there is. I'm suppressing it," he said. "I'm not going to get caught up in it. When I watch the Emmys and the Academy Awards, I feel like I'm in a different business." When we met earlier this month for lunch, Meadows was in New York for a quick trip to promote DMV, before returning to Montreal to finish shooting season one. He suggested we meet at the storied White Horse Tavern in the West Village neighborhood of Manhattan, near where he used to live during his time in SNL. In person, he was warm and reflective, at ease in the dim light of the historic bar. He still feels a connection to the West Village and keeps an apartment in Venice Beach in Los Angeles, but those days he spends most of the year in his hometown Detroit, where he bought a house in 2017. The son of a janitor and a nurse's assistant, Meadows grew up there as the youngest of six siblings. As a young man, he kept the idea of pursuing comedy a secret, he said, and enrolled at Wayne State University in Detroit, where he studied TV and radio broadcasting. Then he saw a newspaper article about local improv classes. He signed up and discovered quickly that the yes and life suited him. He quit school before his junior year and moved to Chicago in the mid-1980s. Success came relatively quickly. Within a few years of relocating, he was hired to the main stage of Second City, performing along the likes of Chris Farley and Bob Odenkirk. It wasn't long before Meadows caught the eye of Lorne Michaels, who had visited Second City specifically to consider recruiting Farley to SNL. Michaels brought Farley on in 1990. Meadows debuted the year after. Meadows became an SNL mainstay, remaining in the cast for 10 seasons, a record until he was passed by Daryl Hammond, who finished with 14. The current record holder is Kenan Thompson at 22 and counting. Like many at SNL cast member, he was encouraged to parlay one of his most popular characters, in his case, the lisping radio host Leon Phelps, otherwise known as the Ladies' Man, into a starring role in a feature film. But The Ladies' Man from 2000, which Meadows co-wrote, was a critical and commercial flop. "It slowed my career down," Meadows said. "It slowed everything down." Meadows, however, said he doesn't resent the fact that some of his peers have had greater box office success. "I can honestly say, lie detector, I have no jealousy or anything with anybody I've worked with that went on to do well," he said. "I'm really happy because it feels like somebody I love." Meadows also just enjoys working. His DMV co-star, Harriet Dyer, described him as perpetually calm on set, eager to talk about his children. One of Meadows' two kids is a senior in college. The other recently graduated. He is relieved they have no interest in pursuing comedy. He said with no hesitation, as his friend and former castmate, Molly Shannon, said in a phone interview, "Meadows can also be deadly serious in the greatest way. There are some comedians that have to be on and are doing bits all the time and are joking, which sometimes can be a way to push people away," she added. "Tim is much more real, wants to get very down to serious business, deep conversation very, very quickly." In recent years, Meadows has begun touring as a stand-up act for the first time, an experience he found humbling in the beginning, he said. "It is a way," he added, "to have an audience validate something stupid he thought up in his car, but it is also a backup plan in case the TV job suddenly dry out." Conceivably, Peacemaker could lead to an expanded role in the DC Comics universe. His character is part of a new crime-fighting team established in the finale. "That would be very exciting," Meadows said, but he isn't counting on it. Similarly, DMV could take up the next 10 years of his life, or it could become like the Michael Richards show, which ran a mere 8 episodes. DMV, at least, has been ordered for a full season. Meadows is prepared for any outcome. For now, he seems content to be a Bill Irwin type, who knows exactly where he fits. "I owe that guy," he said. "I'm glad I had that conversation with him." We only have time to do a little bit of this next article. Why Trump's boat killings would be hard to prosecute. Even if critics who call President Trump's boat attacks murder are right as a matter of law, it would not be easy to get the matter into court. Article by Charlie Savage. A broad range of legal specialists and a growing number of political leaders have called the Trump administration's killing of people at sea it said were drug runners illegal and murders. That accusation invites the question of whether anyone involved may someday be held accountable in court. The administration insists that President Trump has the lawful power to order the summary exjudication killings, and even if the critics are right, there could be many obstacles to prosecutions. For one, future administrations may not want to allow prosecutions, especially of anyone who was simply following orders, both because of the likely political backlash and to avoid setting a precedent that could inhibit their own actions. But even aside from that practical reality, there could be legal impediments to putting the matter before any court. Here's a closer look. What is the legal controversy? It is illegal for the U.S. military to deliberately target civilians, even those suspected of being criminals who do not pose a threat of imminent violence. In peacetime, that is murder. In an armed conflict, that is a war crime. This is according to U.S. laws, including the Uniform Code of Military Justice and international law accepted by the U.S. military. Just as the police arrest people they suspect are drug dealers, rather than shoot them down in the street, the U.S. Coast Guard, sometimes assisted by the Navy, has long dealt with the maritime drug smuggling by intercepting boats and arresting their crews in suspicions of illicit cargo prove accurate. But since September 2nd, on orders from Mr. Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, U.S. Special Operations Forces have been attacking vessels in international waters and killing nearly everyone aboard, blurring the line between enforcing the law and waging a war. Initially, the operation appeared to focus on Venezuelans, but it has increasingly extended to boats carrying Colombians, whose country is a far greater source of narcotics smuggled into the United States. To date, the administration has acknowledged killing 61 people in 14 such strikes. And if you'd like to read the rest of this article, it is from the October 30th, 2025 edition of the New York Times. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 30th, 2025 issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Bruce. Thank you for listening. And as always, make it a great day.